Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Prestige podcast. We are going to once again take liberties with this term because we're talking about 2001's A Knight's Tale that came out May 12th, I believe, in 2001, making this the 20th anniversary, which made me feel really old when I heard this, because I was a young man of just newly minted and vital, and now I'm a wizened husk, and I look back at all these other young, vital, beautiful people, and like, where did it go, Jim? Where did my hair go? Where did my waistline go?
Is it too soon to say you fared better than Heath Ledger did?
Probably.
Okay, I said it anyway.
Yeah, I did think about that a lot, though, watching. Yeah. You can't help but like, geez, what would it,
yeah,
what
talent.
Would he, yeah, if, you know, addiction and depression didn't claim another young life. Do you think that, so like, I have never seen this movie before, because this is when this movie was like, when I saw it, like, I felt like, what was that Drew Barrymore movie about her being in medieval times? I got suckered into watching that around here, and like, I don't like Drew Barrymore, and I really hated that film. When I saw this come out, I'm like, oh, this is another one of those stupid shits. Like,
this could definitely be mistaken for like a Martin Lawrence Black Knight sort of thing.
Or like just like a real, like, I mean, I don't like using this word because it's pejorative, but I'm gonna use this word, a chick flick. Like, sure. You know, just, yeah. but not even a good one. It's just like, looked dumb. It looked hokey. It's like, what they got? They got knights and they're singing queen songs, and they're speaking the king's English, but they're, you know, sort of firing up AC/DC. I'm like, nah, no thanks. Plus it's Heath Ledger, Paul Bettany, Alan, who are these people? Bunch of pretty boys cast, no talent. They're not going to amount to a hill of beans. None of these guys. And I missed it.
Damn.
And then I feel like in the last 5 years, people are like, actually, A Knight's Tale is a really cool, fun movie. So I'm like, oh, maybe I'll check it out one day. And today's the day. Have you seen this film before? What do you think of it?
Yeah, I saw it back in the 2000s at some point.
Really?
I want to say I maybe got the DVD on discount when I worked at Walmart. It was like one of the, like a $5 bin, and I got like 50% off. So I'm like, fuck it. Why not? I pick it up.
Yeah, why not?
And I watched it and I was like, wow, that was actually a ton of fun. I really like that movie. And I'm not a rom-com guy pretty much at all. And this is definitely a rom-com, but the com part of it is so good that I can overlook a lot of just like eye-rolly romantic shit that doesn't do it for me.
Honestly, it feels like, cause I, it's coincidental because like, there's a lot of A Knight's Tale discourse, probably because it's the 20th anniversary. Now I'm thinking about it.
Yeah.
I saw like a Joanna Robinson was talking about this and like retweeting stuff. And I thought she retweeted something along the lines of, it's a shame that A Knight's Tale didn't realize it was a found family film and was stuck into like sports film formula. Where I didn't agree, cause I liked the sports film, like the treating jousting as like a conventional, you know, yeah, sports, like this is a sports tale. This is like Happy Gilmore. This is Hoosiers. This is all that stuff. The found family stuff is in there too. But what I felt really tacked on was the romance. Like, I feel like this, man, I feel like I say this a lot, but like this movie's stronger if you just take all the 20 minutes of him trying to woo this highborn lady and just get the fuck out of there. And you don't have to substitute with like a romance with the blacksmith or the farrier. It's just, you just don't need it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think that they were very charismatic together, and like a lot of that shit was annoying. Like the whole, oh, if you love me, you'll lose and get the shit kicked out of you for like a lose-tage. Like, I don't know, but I really enjoy, like, I, you know, looking back, of course, a movie with like Heath Ledger and Alan Tudyk and Paul Bettany, like sloshing around as kind of like a slightly drunken gambling degenerate Geoffrey Chaucer. How could this movie go wrong? And it really kind of doesn't.
I mean, these actors weren't known then, right? Like, it's certainly not nearly as well as they're known now. I mean, talent.
Had been in things. Like, hadn't he been in The Patriot? Wasn't he like Mel Gibson's son in The Patriot? And he'd done other, but like, yeah, he, you know.
Yeah, like Heath Ledger was a pretty unknown quantity for the most part.
Yeah, he hadn't done Joker, pre-Brokeback. Pre-Joker, yep. And that's the kind of stuff to put him on the map.
And same with the other guys. I had no idea who Mark Addy was at the time. And of course, he went on and became Robert Baratheon in Game of Thrones, mm-hmm. which was awesome. Paul Bettany, everybody knows him at this point. And Alan Tudyk is great. I've seen him in so many things that he is just this character genius, I would say. Yes. He's brilliant at playing these quirky characters. And he does it in this movie, and it works, man. There is so much talent in this movie. It's crazy. And it's just this overlooked sort of mid-2000s rom-com.
I have really grown to appreciate Alan Tudyk over the last year or two. Like, he's done so much brilliant voice work.
Yeah.
And I started just paying attention to that, you know, because he's always been kind of like Wash on Firefly. But the stuff he did in season one of Doom Patrol on HBO was just really fucking next level, and like very funny, but also genuinely menacing and terrifying. The work he did as the Joker on Harley Quinn. Mm-hmm. He's just really like really solid guy. In fact, like at some point I want to have a little debate or discussion of who has the better career right now, Alan Tudyk or Nathan Fillion.
Oh,
because I kind of think Alan Tudyk is out of nowhere fucking,
I mean,
taking Nathan Fillion's lunch.
Fillion fell down a castle hole. I haven't watched a single episode. Well, that's probably not true. I think I've watched like two episodes of Castle in total. And I don't care for procedurals that much, even if they're, you know, right. funny procedurals with Nathan Fillion at the helm. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, Alan Tudyk has done a ton of great stuff. Like my reintroduction to Alan Tudyk after Firefly was Tucker and Dale versus Evil, which is hilarious. That's a great yep. movie, and he's great in it. And then, yeah, all that voice work he's done lately. I'm really enjoying Harley Quinn right now.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, he's had a stellar career. And then Paul Bettany, obviously, is like just blowing up right now with the Marvel stuff.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I've liked him. I fell kind of in love with him during the whole Master and Commander run. And then,
oh, right.
yeah, I consistently liked his work he did on Marvel. And he's done a lot of stuff that I've liked. Beautiful mm-hmm. Mind. I really liked his Figment of Imagination role in that.
Everybody has such a range, right? Because I've with maybe the exception of Tudyk, I haven't seen him do a ton of dramatic stuff. I'm sure he could if he mm-hmm. needed to. But mm-hmm. Paul Bettany, like, In the WandaVision series, right? He's got mm-hmm. those comic chops that you see in this.
Oh my God. Yes.
But he's also got the serious stuff. He can turn on the drama when he needs to. And same with Heath Ledger, right? He's almost the straight man in this. Like, him and Mark Addy are like closest to straight men as possible in this movie, even though they still have a lot of comedic stuff to do. So obviously they both have a ton of range too.
It's funny how your perceptions of people change, because like I saw Mark Addy for the first time consciously in, you know, Game of Thrones. And of course, he makes a pretty fucking big impression as Bobby B.
Yeah.
Fetch me to breastplate stretcher, et cetera, et cetera. But he's like kind of a soft spoken sweetheart in everything I've ever seen him in since, including this film. He's like, you said, the straight man. He's like the sober, responsible one.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Tudyk is the hothead prone to fly into rage and threaten to fong people.
Fong? Yeah. What is fonging? Is that a real word?
That's an archaic English word that means to kick.
Okay.
But it happens to also make modern audiences think about either fuck or fist. Like, mm-hmm. I think you could, there's a couple, like when before I looked it up, I was like, is this something they made up, some kind of balderization or... But yeah, I guess it's like a Chaucer era term for just kicking something or someone.
Nice.
But yeah, I was, you know, let's run down, you know, this movie is directed by Brian Helgeland, who is most known for being a screenplay or screenwriter for the script for L.A. Confidential and Mystic River. Obviously, very well regarded films. But he also wrote and directed 42, the Jackie Robinson biopic. Stars Heath Ledger. Everybody knows who Heath Ledger is. Mark Addy, if you hadn't picked it up, he's Bobby Baratheon from season one of Game of Thrones. Rufus Sewell. I've only seen him play just absolute ridiculous shits. He's like the British James Spader. Like, he's capable of being charming and sophisticated, but he's like mostly cast as like shady villains, romantic villains.
Yeah.
You know,
he's got that face. villainous
face.
He's
got that face. He's got that face, and he does good work here with it. Paul Bettany, who you might recall being Dr. Matron from Master and Commander, the sailing pick that I'm pretty fond of.
Or Vision from all the Marvel movies.
Or Vision from all the Marvel movies, thank you. Alan Tudyk, we've already talked about, you know, he's from Fireflies, from Doom Patrol. It's done a lot of voice work. King Candy from Wreck-It Ralph. Huh. And it started then the Susan or Shannon Sossaman, who also was in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and had a minor role in The Holiday. But I haven't seen her in much, and she didn't make much of an impression. I did like the blacksmith, Laura Fraser, and I did not know this until Jim told me just before we recorded a podcast. Where's she from, Jim?
You probably recognize her from Breaking Bad. She plays Lydia, which is hilarious because I'm watching this movie and I'm going, and I'm looking down at my notes and I'm looking up at the screen and I'm like seeing this person, you know, across the way, and I don't recognize her. And then they walk over to her blacksmithing stall, and she opens her mouth. I'm like, oh, that's Lydia from Breaking Bad. Even though she's putting on some kind of accent here, I recognized her not from what she looks like, even though she looks exactly like she does as Lydia, but from the weird accented non-Lydia voice she's doing. She has a very distinctive way of talking.
Yep. A woman who deserves to die as much as any man I've ever met.
It's true.
And that's yeah, just a couple like Mace Tyrell, the patriarch of the Tyrell branch of the Game of Thrones cast. Marjorie's dad, Lady Olenna, Queen of Thorns' son, kind of like hapless Lord Sits a Banquet, I think is one of his nicknames on the show. He shows up as a kind of a stuffy monk in the early goings. There's a few other people I recognized here and there, but it's mostly like an ensemble cast. Like it's like this is like medieval Friends, and that's the main cast. Before we go on and talk, like I guess spoilers for this silly movie we're talking about, I should give the standard synopsis. This is a movie about a peasant squire for a knight. Who the movie opens, they're at a tournament. The elderly knight is past his prime and actually dies, but he's got a 3-lance lead in this minor backwater tournament, and Heath Ledger, who is the squire, decides to break the law. Only nobility are allowed to joust, you see, and wear his patron's armor, and all he has to do is not get knocked off and he wins. So they win, and instead of splitting the meager reward three ways between Mark Addy and Alan Tudyk, they decide to plow that into training and equipment and trust in Heath Ledger to be good enough to win tournaments and win money. Along the way, they meet degenerate gambler Geoffrey Chaucer, who would go on to write the Canterbury Tales, and he starts following them as kind of like bard and herald. Forges some official aristocratic paperwork for him, so everything's all legit and legal, and it becomes a sport. It's a standard sports movie. Jousting is a sport. Heath Ledger is the up and coming star. How high can he rise? Can he win the heart of the lady that is kind of sweet on him? Will his deep dark peasantry past ever be discovered? Do you think maybe at a crucial point in the third act, it'll be discovered? Nah, you probably don't see that coming. Will he win the final joust? Who knows? Maybe he'll fucking end up dead or maimed or something. It could be like a fucking Braveheart situation. You think?
You know, it's hilarious because you're going on about how predictable this movie it is. And it totally is. Like, all those things happen, definitely. But also, it plays with so many conventions of, like, historical dramas, right? That it's kind of strange that they didn't subvert expectations in the plot, because they do with like the music and like the characters and the time period. All this stuff is just like remixed, but they don't really do it with the plot. It's pretty straightforward romantic comedy action drama.
But
this is
aimed squarely at kind of young adults. And, you know, if you're a young adult and you watch it and you grow up and now you're a middle-aged adult, like a lot of us are, you still have affection for it, but like it's definitely, you know, it's not there. But it's funny because the movie was so close to being a little bit more than it was that I kept on expecting it, kind of, and it kind of let me down. For example, they have like, there's all this like class commentary throughout the whole movie. And we're gonna have to spoilers now. If you want to bail on this on this and go watch it, but like, you know, there's a whole this thing about you know, what makes people really worth this or that and the other, and you know, like unearned privilege and all this other stuff, and you know, this guy changing his stars and all that stuff, and then he gets exposed as a peasant and he gets put in the stockades, and then this prince that has been disguising as royal, because there's this obscure, you know, like everyone knows about the rule. You're not allowed to like assault royalty. So like, you know, these guys could never, I don't know if this is true or not, but it's like Game of Thrones true. That's true enough for me. That you can't assault these royal personages, not even in like training or any. So like, you know, the paradox is they want to win glory in battle, but they can't ever really can't win glory in tournaments because no one will strike him. Everybody yields to him, blah, blah, blah. This guy, because Heath Ledger's character has impressed him a few times earlier in the movie with his nobility and his grace and his, you know, showing the knightly code that you're supposed to uphold, decides to reveal his parentage. Like, it's just weird. Like, it's almost like you guys put him in stocks because you thought he's no low born, but he's actually high born. So there. And I thought that it was going to be like, he's just
right. He just tells everybody that he is.
I get that. I didn't get that. But then when I was thinking about it, I'm like, well, okay, what he actually says is he's highborn and it's my word. But like,
yeah,
isn't one of the powers of these royal people the ability to just knight somebody for like meritorious? Like, what if he just pulls them out of the stocks and says, enough of this. This guy has been merciful and just and brave and everything a knight should be. And I'm going to pull my sword out and I'm going to dub thee Sir William. Like, I thought it was weird that like we made all these statements about like how this class thing is kind of garbage and it's American film. And we kind of like, it's one thing we all agree. And it's like, in theory, class distinctions are kind of garbage. And then at the end of it, it's just like, not married. It's like, yeah, I don't know. I kept on thinking there might be, I kept also thinking there might be a little subversion of like the romantic relationship, but after a few kind of paying lip service to her being kind of you know, different and modern, her thinking, like, it kind of pretty much became a standard, you know, say anything type of romance.
Yeah.
Big showy things to prove love and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I definitely don't think this movie is perfect, but it is a ton of fun.
Yeah. How much of the fun is the juxtaposition of the set and setting and like the tone and the music and things?
Tons of it. It's like 70% that and 30% that the comedy is good. And that's kind of the fun of the movie.
Because I was wondering, like, would this work as well if it didn't? Because like, I don't know. I want to believe what you're saying, but also like, I guess, do you really think that like if they didn't have Queen and AC/DC and like what is the other one, David Bowie, like if everything else is just straight, because like it's, and also like where did they draw the line? I think that was interesting. Like, their costuming is pretty, I don't know if it's like, because I don't even know what the fucking period this is supposed to go for, but it feels
it's like
authentic.
The late 1300s.
Yeah, it's not like Excalibur or like Armies of Darkness, where it's just like, you know, the just either a fantasy knight or like a sketch of like, okay, this is kind of like some mail and some halberds and some tunics and stuff. It looks good. Like, they sweated the medieval details. They're also like talking in what's an affected kind of 16th century accent or like medieval ages accent. The only thing that's like modern is like the music itself. I wonder where they decided to draw the line of like, you know, like let's just Moulin Rouge this, where it's like pretty much period, except we're going to have like, you know, anachronistic music.
Yeah, I feel like some of the sensibilities of the characters are far more modern than you would
That's
expect.
Fair.
But you're right. I don't know. It seems like that's where they draw the line. Like, some of the characters are given some agency beyond maybe what they would have had at the time period. Mm-hmm. And then also the music, right?
Because like the music is fun, but like it's not like, I don't think the crowd reaction, I guess there's one point where like everyone spontaneously breaks out in a modern dance from like stilted medieval kind of march.
I mean,
but
the music is part of the movie. It's not just like, oh, they took medieval scenes and put Queen behind it. It's right. No, the crowd is singing We Will Rock You. Like, it is part of the event that's happening on screen. When they go and do Golden Years and the dance, like, The up-tempo dance they're doing is to that song. It's not to some medieval thing that we can't hear.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like in the first scene, like when they're doing the We Will Rock You, it's like they're singing a modern song. But like the behavior of the crowd, like from what I can tell, is like pretty standard raucous Middle Ages, public execution, jousting, eating, drinking. You know, like it's not like the raucous nature, like the football hooligan nature of the crowd was anachronistic. It's just like, again, the soundtrack they set it to. And what I'm getting at is like,
well, but they're stamping their feet and clapping their hands like to the beat of We Will Rock You, like,
yeah,
doing the thing that everybody does when We Will Rock You comes on, right?
Yeah. Did people not do that before We Will Rock You, or did We Will Rock You work as stadium rock because that's what people do in stadiums? They stamp their feet to like bleachers and they clap and they cheer.
Yeah, but they didn't do it to the beat of We Will Rock You is my point. Like they are literally hearing the song We Will Rock You in that scene. Like
You're right. I'm backing down off of this hill. I will advance my next argument. It seems like when people do this, it's wildly successful. And I cite like Romeo and Juliet. I cite the modern one with Leo DiCaprio and what's her face? Homeland girl.
Claire Danes.
Woman. Yeah. Claire Danes, thank you. And Leguizamo, of course.
Moulin Rouge.
This movie, it seems like when it's kind of like what would you call that? Like, you're not gender or race bending, you're time bending. Mm-hmm. And I guess Guardians of the Galaxy, I'd even put that because that's like usually when you see a science fiction show like Dune or Star Wars or so, like it's not recognizably our culture in space.
Yeah,
it's like some other culture. It's the Federation and they're like advanced beyond us, or they're like faux English because you got to know their villain or whatever. But like Guardians of the Galaxy is essentially what if our culture, but in space, and it's our culture is monolithically everywhere in space. Like every alien behaves in a recognizably funny, goofy, Joss Whedon-y kind of way in space. Like,
yeah,
I guess why don't people do that more often? Like have that like little, because people just go crazy fucking for it.
Yeah, I love it. And this movie was definitely unique the first time I saw it, and maybe still to this day. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it in that. You know, in Guardians, like you get the feeling that what's the main character?
Star-Lord
has brought like that 80s, you know, nostalgia and like that vibe to space with him, that sort of thing. In this, it's just kind of there for no reason, right? It's like,
yeah,
it's a stylistic choice instead of like a plot choice. And that to me was like totally unique. I didn't know why they were doing it, but it worked and I loved it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was just trying to put my finger on exactly what they were doing and why. Like again, like
they're just like having Romeo fun. And it feels like
Romeo and Juliet. It's like it's exactly period accurate, like Shakespeare. It's just a costuming and the setting,
right? It's modern.
Day. Is completely modern, right? Mm-hmm. And this is like, you know, the set and all that stuff is very antique, but and the dialogue even, but like the sensibilities and the music is upgraded. And yeah, I just think that's interesting. Like when you're adapting this stuff, like who came up with that idea? Where they come from? There's not a lot of like in-depth like making a production behind this film because like no one expected this to be like a beloved classic or anyone to think about it in this kind of depth. So
yeah, I don't think anybody was demanding that.
Yeah. Maybe I need to see the Blu-ray commentary.
I was going to say, yeah, there is DVD commentary, which I guess has some interesting stuff on it, but I don't know. I've never heard it. There's one other anachronism that I wanted to talk about that I noticed, and it's like, it's gotta be intentional. There's no way they didn't put this in there knowing that you would hopefully see it. When they're headed back to London for that final tournament, you can see like a wide shot of London and you can see the Ferris wheel in the background, which is totally an anachronism for that time.
Sure.
Uh-huh. And I'm like, that's a weird detail to put in. Like, I know London has that big Ferris wheel, right? But
do you think they just didn't bother to paint, digitally paint it? Because they had to do so much digital work on making London look like it's the 11th century or whatever the hell it's supposed to look like.
Yeah, so did they just like put a veneer over everything that was there? But there are no tall buildings. It's all like small you know, just paint
it,
shit.
Or is it as a joke, or like, I wonder, like, and I wish I'd seen that, because I would have tried to freeze frame on, and like, did they give it like a wooden patina? Like,
I think you're supposed
to understand this is some kind of clockwork Ferris wheel.
Yeah, I don't know. That was a weird one to me. It puzzled me.
So this is a sports film and a sports around jousting, and I've seen a fair amount of live jousting. I've been to quite a few Renaissance fairs, and that's always a staple. And I'm always amazed, like, that people do this, that people did do this in the olden times. It seems very painful. Injuries are rife. I don't think these Renaissance fair guys get paid a lot. It seems like they're all like a bunch of 18-year-old like wannabe stuntmen that just really want to do this thing and damn the consequences. And I noticed, like, you know, this is a really jousting heavy movie. And jousting is like crazy dangerous. It involves horses, which is, you know, just dangerous. It involves high impact speed, just as dangerous, splintering wood. And I wondered, because, like, man, I noticed that these like lances were just fucking exploding.
Yeah.
Like, it is like I started noticing like these like almost improbably lance explosions. I'm like, I wonder, did they rig these up? I did some looking into it, and I guess they used wooden lances that were hollowed out and filled with balsa splinters and uncooked linguine. Linguine? Right. Linguine?
Uh-huh.
And they had balsa wood tips, so like you could just take these things on the face and it would just like, there's like no possible way it could harm you. But it looks incredibly realistic. Like some of these hits and stuff is like fucking vicious, man.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially that first one that he takes to the face that bends his helmet all up. I was like, oh my God, that's devastating.
Yeah, that was a hell of a punch. Or like the losing montage where his lady sent him on a, like, that was just like fucking brutal to watch. And, you know, you see them paying a price with the bruises all over his body. Yeah. But like, if you're going to, it's like, that's the thing. It's like, if you're going to make a movie about like basketball, you better have pretty convincing basketball. If you're going to make a movie about et cetera, et cetera. And like, I feel like that's the one thing this movie had to do. And they pretty much nailed it with the jousting.
I think so. The one complaint I have, and maybe I'm just not like getting it and how jousting works and stuff, but it seemed like every time they would show those close ups when they're just about to hit, you'd show the opponent like pulling their lance away, like turning the opposite direction. And I don't know if that's just them saying, hey, this shit is hard, and a horse moves away you don't expect and you just get thrown totally off. Or if that's them pulling the punch so that they only have to take the hits that the actors need to take.
That's interesting, because I didn't notice that. And there's even like, I don't know, because there's also like, yeah, they talk about jousting strategy about like, well, you should tilt and let the lance skirt off of this shoulder. And it's like, what if he hits me on my other shoulder? It'll kill me. And I'm like, so like maybe there was. Yeah, I couldn't. Because they also like sometimes they used the jouster's injury or wariness level to kind of communicate like how the joust was going. Like if Heath Ledger was charging and he wasn't like dead on center, then like, oh, something's wrong. Or his opponent do the same thing. But like, yeah, I noticed there was some just kind of like crazy lance work. So I guess, yeah, like even if it's a balsa wood lance, it's still wood hitting you at 35 miles an hour combined collision impact, 40 mile an hour. It's like, yeah, you probably want to reduce that to the stuntman no matter how you do it.
Yeah, and there were a lot of them too. There's a lot of jousting in this movie, and a lot.
There's
of hits.
A ton. That's what I'm saying. There's like lots and lots of jousting footage, and they also keep it interesting. Like, there's probably five different jousting or joust training montages, and they always find the way to make it look interesting, visually interesting, to kind of like, you know, if you don't know how jousting goes, I don't know how jousting goes, but it's like, oh, three lances to none, and. You got to knock him off or kill him. So I guess knocking him off is worth three and exploded lance is worth one. And
they do a great job of keeping you up to date on the stakes here and like what you need to win and what you need to hope for in the next round. In order for the heroes to win. And the way they film it is really cool. Like they it seems to me like they have, you know, a horse and some kind of camera set up. Moving the same direction, and the horse is moving just a little faster, and they're shooting it in slow-mo, and so the camera's getting like closer, and it feels like the horse is running past you and you're the opponent, but it's all moving in like slow motion. It's it's really well shot, that part of it.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of how we talked about chess and like Queen's Gambit and Searching for Bobby Fischer. It's like you don't need to understand it. You just have to understand who's winning or losing. And it's got to look visually interesting.
Yep.
And yeah, this movie easily scores very high in both of those, which is good because that's what this movie is all about. It's like, again, if you had a basketball, I always like every once in a while you'll see a basketball movie where the star like is like staring at the ball as he dribbles it. You know, and then like, you know, they cut away and there's a dude that's like 4 inches taller with different hair and he's slam dunking it. It's like, it's not, you're not fooling anybody. But this stuff, of course, it also helps that you've got, you know, knights wearing these huge visors and, you know, like, you know, obviously this isn't Heath Ledger. I kind of want to go through the cast. We've talked about a lot of them in Mass, but I just kind of want to talk about them individually. I don't think there was a lot of flashes of what would make Heath Ledger great in this movie. Isn't Heath Ledger tall and handsome with pretty hair and nice eyes and just a very cute smile?
Yeah.
And he's also kind of like throws tantrums a little bit. He's got, you know, he's all pouty sometimes and he's just kind of adorable. But he doesn't really, in my mind, he's like the bland front man of a boy band. Like, yeah, a lot, everyone says, but like, you know, secretly most people are probably, you know, fantasizing about Paul Bettany or Tudyk or Mark Addy, right?
Paul Bettany is showing them all up. And well, with the exception of maybe Alan Tudyk, they're, you know, jockeying for number one ham in this.
Yeah, it's one of those where the star of the movie is kind of like the most boring dude in it.
Yeah.
Like I said, it's not his fault. He's doing exactly what the movie calls for. It's just, you know, he's the boring dude in this one.
And if they didn't have those side characters, I wouldn't have watched or I wouldn't have liked this movie.
There'd be literally nothing for anyone to do because most of the meat of the film, the stuff that like, you know, you probably on rewatches or your favorite parts are the character interactions, you know, like Alan Tudyk threatening Bettany with a good, good fonging or, you know, Mark Addy being exasperated with everything he's seeing and stuff like that. I want to talk about Mark Addy, too. Because he's another one, the straight man, he doesn't have a lot to do and there's not.
Yeah,
like every other film I've ever seen him in, there's nothing in this to suggest that he's going to be bellowing with like beard running down his beard as he's juggling three women and trying to pry his ass into a set of armor. But that's you need a guy that's even more boring than the hero to kind of contrast. So that's what Mark Addy does here. I don't have much to say more about him.
Yeah, he's trying to ground this romantic a little bit, right? This kid with like high ideas.
Yeah. Rufus, who plays the villain, whose name I do not recall. I was kind of impressed because I thought that they were going to make him out to be kind of a dandy, you know, but like he actually is playing essentially the Black Knight. His armor is bad. Is always the most badass on the field. It's like very like dark, like almost black gunmetal gray. He's fucking butch. The only reason he's a villain is because he has a sneering contempt for the peasant class. Otherwise,
and his views on like the women are certainly
and women
of the age.
I should say sneering contempt for anyone that he sees as beneath him.
Sure,
and that includes peasants. That includes women. That includes like I think religion. He doesn't have a go at some religious figure or something.
I think basically everyone in this movie except for the prince.
Yeah. And what I thought really funny is there's a scene where like him and Heath Ledger are rivals. And he's always kind of skeptical about like, you know, he comes from Liechtenstein and Heath Ledger does. And he's like, he's got the scene where he's looking at his old armor and he's like, oh, how charming. My grandfather would be happy to know that he can get his armor out of storage and wear it again. And oh, these rustic knights from faraway lands are really no better than peasants, all that stuff. But there's a scene like in the middle of the movie where he gets sent off to war. Legitimate war.
Yeah.
Real war. Killing dudes. Killing dudes with lances and sword. Charging them in battle. And he's obsessively going over the scrolls from the tourneys back home. And I got this mind is like, this is like a Navy SEAL going, like, you know, he rolls out of the black, he rolls into Blackhawk, he just killed, like, you know, four tangos, he rolls back to base, and he's the first thing he does, he gets on his Xbox and sees what is like, you know, it's like, oh god damn it, fucking 420 nugget gangster is got 0.3 more kill to death ratio than me, god damn it, I can't fucking believe this. Like, isn't it wild that, like, he's so super competitive with the fake war when he's actually distinguished himself in, like, real war?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it was hilarious.
On the other hand, I don't know. Like, I'm sure they have Xboxes and PlayStations on Army and Marine and naval bases.
Oh, they do.
All over the place. And I'm sure that by their nature, they're highly competitive people. I just thought that was so super funny to be this guy in a fake war is kicking my ass in the real war games. I was like,
soaking up all the glory. Who's going to hear about
this
battle?
The fake glory. Stolen valor, man. It's, Heath Ledger. He's not noble. He's never been in war.
And so the dude goes across the country committing atrocities in order to get pulled from the war. Is that what I read from the description?
Did he?
I don't know.
I thought the war just got over and he came back.
Maybe.
But I guess
him as a really bad guy, saying, oh, all those atrocities you committed over there, doing what, old school atrocities in modern ways?
A bloody Bannon type of guy from, like, the Patriots. Like, he's don't approve of your methods. Don't approve of your methods, Sir Rufus. I admire your results, but your methods, I don't know about, Mr. Rufus. But this guy, I don't know what else to say about him. He's just like, he's just a bad guy. Mm-hmm. Paul Bettany does a lot in this movie. Shows up full ass naked. The only thing you don't see is his twig. extended
twice.
Naked.
I
extended
love it.
extended nudity from Paul Bettany. It's always a crowd pleaser. You know, mm-hmm. Paul Bettany's also like many men in Hollywood. Have you noticed that, like, the dearth of just average dudes in Hollywood nowadays?
Oh yeah.
Like, everyone's getting
Paul Giamatti's
jacked.
Holding that flag, that last flag.
He's holding the line, but, like, everyone's getting Marvel jacked because who knows, man? Sam Jackson might retire as Nick Fury and they'll need Nick Fury 2.0, and I'm 55 years old and so, but I'm still gonna keep my shit tight because who knows, I might get that call. Yeah. Or they're just, like, all out schlubs.
Sure.
But this was, like, and now Paul Bettany has got the classically triangular torpedo. Like, he's Marvel jacked. This movie he was just a dude.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. He's just a dude. He's got just a dude's ass hanging out in front of me. He's hilarious.
Yeah.
I thought that his, like, Carnival Barker act would get old, but it kept on getting more and more elaborate and it was just more and more delightful. Just not just the effect he had on the crowd, but, like, him being pleased with his own performance. Increasingly is what killed me.
It's great. And the hammer for me is the final joust when what's the guy's name, Adderall or something, when
Sir Rufus,
when Sir Adderall's Harold comes out there and tries to do the shtick that Bettany's been doing the whole movie, and he's just like, no dude, don't even try it, you're not that guy, you're not Geoffrey Chaucer.
I never suspected that Paul Bettany could be this funny, because I obviously hadn't seen this movie until, like I said, the second episode of WandaVision is worth watching just to see, like, a really good physical comedy skit.
Yeah.
And he's really funny in that. He's very, very, very funny in this. And he's been, like, he's not funny like Master and Commander, but it's more of, like, a sly, you know, British kind of funny. A dry wit. This is just, there's a lot of, like, slapstick and just him. You know, like, the scene of him, like, he keeps giving the business to Alan Tudyk, and Alan Tudyk's a violent maniac, and he keeps, like, I love the, like, you know, smash cut to him being punched, and then he's, without breaking his dialogue, you see him with, like, stuff shoved up his nose to stop his nose bleeding, and is, like, he's got a black eye, and he's still talking shit.
Yeah, no, it's great. And that second time, the first time, you know, Paul Bettany shows up naked, you're like, oh boy. The second time, it's played for just pure comedy, right? Where, like, the next time you meet him, he's caught by his debt collectors and he's completely naked again. And then Alan Tudyk attacks him when he's naked, gets him in a headlock, starts punching him, bends him over, starts punching him. It's really funny.
It is. It's really funny.
It's a lot of good physical comedy and some of that sly stuff from both of those guys.
Yeah, even like kind of like relatively dumb or obvious things like at the closing of the training montage when he is like Mark Addy and Tudyk are dragging him down a canal for him to get this ring.
Oh,
and,
I love that.
And he finally gets the ring, but he falls over backwards and they're like, celebrating. But like, you know, Heath Ledger's, it's just a Jamie Lannister problem. He's wearing 50 pounds of armor and he's at the bottom of this river and he can't get out. And Mark Addy's like, anytime. And then they kind of realize that. And it's to the movie's credit, they don't smash cut to them like, you know, doing CPR on him or anything. It's just, it's a funny situation. The knight getting knocked off and what the hell is he going
to
do?
This movie has a good comedic timing to it, right? It lets you realize the joke and then moves on. It doesn't linger too long.
And it's pretty steadily, evenly paced. Like every 3 to 5 minutes, there'll be just like, and then there's not like a gut busting moment. There are a couple like really funny moments, but it's just kind of like, you know, hey, you're having fun. It's like the kind of funny when you're with your friends is kind of hanging out.
And the way, I don't know why, but the way that Sir Ulrich keeps calling Paul Bettany's character Jeff the whole time. Yeah. He's just like, hey, Jeff. Uh-huh, it's such like a modern name modern sounding name that I'm like, what?
It's funny. Yeah, and it's funny. This is the idea of this like literate poet and, you know, like the abilities, what he could do for like this band of kind of like, you know, upjunk hedge knights. It's funny. It's a really funny concept. Alan Tudyk is he's playing pretty broad. He's essentially just the angry guy. He's playing like if this movie were made today, like Danny McBride would be in this role.
Sure.
But he's just there to be kind of like unreasonable, like kind of like the loudish. He's very loud. He's prone to violence, threatening everyone to a good falling on several occasions. Mm-hmm. But a stalwart friend. And then Laura, like, I don't know what to say about Shannon Sossaman because she's just a really pretty face that smiles coquettishly and then gets frowny face. I mean, there's a couple like, I don't know, like there's this one scene where like, Heath Ledger is mad that he lost to Sir Rufus and he's just being a shit to everybody. And he gives her the business because she's in there like excited about a ball. And he's like, oh, your girl stuff is stupid. And she's like, well, your boy stuff is stupid, too. And there was kind of something there. But like, I don't know.
I like her. She's good with what she's given here. Which is something I guess a little more than I expected, you know, in these rom-com movies, typically the woman is just like an object to be chased. And that's true here too, but there's something about this character where they give her a personality, not just, you know, objectifying her totally. I don't know, but it is cheesy. It is like,
the movie gets pretty fucking meta when the hero and the villain are debating about the fact that she is essentially a trophy to be won. And like Heath Ledger's lines are essentially, well, yeah, but it's not what I feel. That's how I feel about it. You know?
Sure. Like, yeah.
Rufus is like, it is what it is, man. She's the best looking lady with the best breeding and I'm going to make her mine. I'm going to saddle her and add her to. And they also have this really tortured metaphor of her being a horse to saddle and a trophy to win.
Yeah.
And I'm like, do they realize how stupid this sounds? And then as I was thinking that, Rufus literally says, I'm going to saddle her and put her on my mantle, like cementing the fucking like busted ass analogy. So then Laura Frazier, I mean, she's fine. She's there to be, it's a little bit cringy in the beginning because like Heath Ledger just easily manipulates her into giving him free armor because he's like, oh, this other fucking blacksmith said that you're a fucking woman and you can't armor for shit. And she's like, oh yeah. And that's how she joins the gang. And they give her a little bit, like, why do they give her this tragic, like, widow backstory?
Because otherwise she'd have nothing in this. She would literally just be the person who makes his new armor.
It's almost like they threw that in there to be like, well, we might wonder why this woman just goes off and leaves her village and goes gallivanting with these guys. You know, she's a successful blacksmith.
Fine. I like filling those holes, but also I don't think she's given enough. Well,
yeah.
I mean, any hole I'll fill it, of course. but no, I wish that they had given her more to do because she is just kind of there in the background waiting to teach these guys to dance eventually.
Yeah, this movie, we talked, me and Joanne and Kim talked about this on the holidays. Like, these are one of these transitional movies as far as like with modern sensibilities, where it's like you could tell, man, we don't want to just bring girls on here and give them nothing to do. So like, we know that's bad, but we also don't know how to fully realize a character like this and give them equal screen time. And like, you know, we don't have the shortcuts and all this stuff that'll later be pioneered. So like, it's she's the blacksmith, and she's actually secretly the best blacksmith, and not just the best blacksmith. She's like pioneering crazy alloy technology that makes armor stronger and lighter. Mm-hmm. And that's it. She's Rick's super competent blacksmith, and she's a woman. Makes you think. And she's Lydia from Breaking Bad, who's pretty good at playing super competent characters, it turns out.
Yeah.
The other thing that felt weirdly disconnected is the father's role in this. Like, his father, how does Heath Ledger, like, the movie even kind of tries to lampshade it, but it doesn't successfully lampshade it. Heath Ledger makes the observation, is like, oh, why did I think my dad was dead? He's always been strong as an ox, and I've only been gone 12 years, and he was only like in his, like, yeah, you know, like, I get the average age of death in the medieval age was 50, but you know, a lot of that's infant mortality, and you know, if you survived through your 30s, you usually were able to make it to your 60s or 70s. Like, it's weird that the movie even gave him this dad plot, because like, I never felt like, I mean, literally the movie tacked it on. Like, there was three flashbacks where they showed the relationship he had with his father, and his father shared his dream of being a knight and sacrificed all this stuff to be a knight, and then brought it back in the end. But like, I don't know, because it was also his downfall. Like, that, none of this stuff kind of hung together for me, because why did Sir Rufus follow him to Cheapside, which I don't know if that's a real district in London. I think that's brilliant. I love that someone's calling something the equivalent of Shantytown or Fleabottom or something like that. He's going, why would he follow this knight just around? Why would he go to, I thought they were going to make it to where that girl betrayed him, the little girl that lives in his village or something, for like a couple of pieces of gold or whatever.
Right. I assumed so.
Yeah, I didn't know what to make of the dad plot. It's another one that felt like this is like a 100-minute movie that's 135, and that it's not the love interest and the dad's fault, and it's not the interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I like the dad plot, but it doesn't make a lot of sense. You're right, especially Sir Shitbag following him there.
He's been winning gold, tourney gold, for years or for a long time, and hasn't sent anything back to his dad because he just assumed his dad's dead. Never heard anything. It's only been 12 years. Dad's probably dead.
Yeah.
He's getting to be in his 40s now. No way. No fucking way. Thatcher? No way. No way. He's falling off a roof. No way. it's weird. And then the way like the movie makes it like the ending revolves around his father, like hearing Sir William of Thatchery or whatever, and like getting tears in his blind eyes, and like his highborn girlfriend going and getting him out of Fleabottom and bringing him into the royal press box. It's like all that stuff. Like, yeah, I don't know. It came out of nowhere, and it didn't really connect with me. One other thing I thought was weird. Sir Rufus, at one point when he first jousts Sir Ledger of Heath, or Sir Heath of Ledger, he looks up at his like distinctive fist shaped lance, like, and I thought for sure when he was charging, he was going to operate some kind of crazy lever, and that fist was going to retract, and a spike was going to come out of it. And it never did. And it never did. And like he fought him like two more times, and nothing. Like they do this thing where it's like Rufus literally looks up at his lance, and the camera zooms in on that fist. Then at the end of the movie, they do something where it's like, he tipped it. But I have no fucking clue what tipping meant or did. And like it felt like his Chekhov's lance, but I didn't quite figure out what they were trying to suggest, what he actually did.
There's a really quick line there as he's preparing to run down that field, where his I don't know, steward, whatever, hands him his lance and says, this, it's essentially just what is it, sponge sugar, and he crushes the fist, right? And you see the tip of the lance is pointed, whereas it's not supposed to be. And so they put a sugar shell around the front so you couldn't tell that it was tipped until it hit him and broke, and then it would pierce him.
So, like, did he have that sugar stick in the first place and he's thinking about, maybe I should crush it? Or, like, also, why would you ever crush it in advance?
You wouldn't. You only do that for the movie to show the audience. Okay. It was kind of stupid because, right. Like, I got it. Oh, you say it's spun sugar. And then when it shows and it hits him and they say, oh, he tipped it. And you'd eventually get all that. But, yeah, it was a little silly there. And I don't know why you don't take that over. Like, oh, everybody sees, oh, he tipped it. Why don't you take that over to some of the officials here and say, hey, look, this motherfucker's cheating.
Right. He tipped it.
He's trying to kill this guy.
The tip is stuck into my arm. Yeah. Right? Here's the evidence. I got tipped.
Right. But, it's pride. It's wanting to beat this dude, even though he's playing the unfair game, whatever.
And that's the other thing is, like, it also felt like the whole, like, you should run kind of thing. It's like, yeah, you should run. He's like, no, I'm going to show up to fight. Well, do you understand that they're not going to let you fight?
Right.
That's not a thing that's going to happen, and you're just going to go instantly. It's not like if you could knock this guy off his horse and win and then go to the stockades, mm-hmm. fine. That's one thing. But, like, yeah, the only thing that made that actually okay and work out in the terms of the movie is that, you know, Sir whatever Prince Black Philip or whatever his name happened to say to ride in there and save the day.
Yeah.
Do you want to have a serious conversation about, like, whether Alan Tudyk or Nathan Fillion has a better career at this point? Because the more I think about it, like, what's Nathan Fillion got other than Castle and Mal Reynolds from Firefly?
He's got people.
Halo. Really, he's got Halo Dr. screen Horrible. Credit. He's got Dr. Horrible sing along blog. Okay, that's good. That's fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting work, but it's like one of those, like, writer shutdown. Like, if you've seen it, like, I've seen it just a year or two ago, because Jack wanted to see it for some reason. And I remember thinking, like, this doesn't hold up as much as I thought it did.
I thought we might have covered that in a podcast.
We did. It was an early commission, like, 5 years ago. And I remember really, really liking it. But I don't know, because that's like that's not a real thing. Like, that's like a writer strike student film project to amuse the people that were in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it's not a real thing, but I'm like, you know, it's like, what is it, 45 minutes long or something?
Yeah.
Nathan Fillion was arguably the star of Destiny until they wrote him out like 2 years ago.
Brought in Peter Dinklage. Is that right?
No, they just killed off his character. Now, Peter Dinklage got turned into, I don't know, one of the other, you know, who's there's just like three dudes that do voices Hollywood.
Yeah, I know who you're talking about, but
yeah. Sure. Alan Tudyk, though, so he's got the Firefly cred, clearly not the lead role. He was Pirate Steve in Dodgeball. He's got this, which is a bigger movie than I suspected it of. It made over, you know, $100 million in America on a $20 million budget.
No, this had a massive budget. This is a $65 million film.
Did it?
Yeah, okay. It doesn't really feel like it.
No, I mean, I guess the armor and those locations and stuff are kind of expensive.
It must have been.
And tons of extras, too. Like, they had cast of hundreds in this thing.
Yeah, and made like double its money. So it was successful for sure.
Hmm. He's got lots of voice credits, including, like I said, Pixar films. He's been in several Pixar films. He played the only white guy in all of Moana. Only white person in all Moana was the chicken, played by Alan Tudyk. He did really good work, as I said, in Doom Patrol on HBO. He wasn't as much in the second season because he had, ironically, I think the Harley Quinn work he did interfered with that. But I think he'll probably be back in future seasons. I don't know, man. Like, I feel like they're kind of at parity right now, and I don't know what Nathan Fillion's next role is, because, like, the thing that Nathan Fillion's famous for doing, which is being handsome and Nathan Fillion, like, eventually those roles will stop coming to him because he's going to get, like, he'll be old, not quite as handsome Nathan Fillion. Alan Tudyk's just getting started, man.
Yeah.
Like, with his character actor shit.
I don't know. It looks like Marvel's MODOK, he's gonna play a character in that coming up, and Suicide Squad, boy, he's doing both those, huh?
I don't see Nathan Fillion doing AAA stuff.
No, those are Nathan Fillion roles.
Oh, Nathan Fillion. Okay, I thought you were talking about Tudyk.
No, okay, he's well, done a shitload something. Of TV. Just like he's on every television show you can think of.
Hmm. I don't want to start a big war between the Tudyks and the Fillions, but it's a debate, and I wouldn't have thought that possible 10 years ago.
I will say, personally, I like the stuff that Alan Tudyk has done better than I like the stuff that Nathan Fillion has done, but that wouldn't be true, obviously, yeah, for a Castle fan, because there's so much of that.
Yeah, and that's the other thing, is like Nathan Fillion is always Nathan Fillion
uh-huh.
in everything I've ever seen him in, whereas Alan, like, what is an Alan Tudyk performance? In this era, you could kind of be, oh, he's a broad comedic kind of like, right. But like nowadays, like with his voice work and with some of the other dramatic stuff with the, I guess, Dale and Tucker, that's pretty broadly comedic. Yeah.
Yeah. That's of the Knight's Tale, the Firefly kind of genre. Yeah.
He's playing a hillbill. I mean, it's like, it's not, it's not like the Alan, it's not like he's just Alan Tudyk, you know?
Oh, no, his characters are very different, but the tone of what he does is very similar. Movie to movie.
Oh, for sure. What is there anything else we want to talk about when it comes to this movie?
The soundtrack is amazing. It has
sure
enormous gets as far as bands and songs. Like, it's got David Bowie in it. You know, everybody mm-hmm. everybody knows the "We Will Rock You" song from this movie. It's got two Queen songs in it. It's got that David Bowie song. Which was
funny for the jousting montage.
Taking Care of Business. The Boys Are Back in Town. Like, all these.
That was a good one when they got back to London. Yeah.
I think AC/DC. Yeah. There's a track from AC/DC in this too.
You Should Be All Night Long. That's like the intro, the outro to credits track. Yeah.
Yeah. Just a ton of great music. And, you know, it goes back to those anachronisms that we're talking about. And a couple others that I liked. There's one moment where, the farrier who's making the armor makes the armor for him and then puts a trademark on it, which is just a couple of Nike swooshes, which I thought was pretty funny. And she basically invents the term trademark in that scene.
Yeah.
And then when they're in the pub and they're being taunted by the French, who say, oh yeah, Frenchmen will win this tournament. They sing a song that's very like soccer hooligan, I don't know, very English soccer hooligan about how you know, Ulrich's gonna win, which I thought was interesting. And one other, when they hit he hits a knight so hard with the joust during the joust that his helmet goes flying off and like goes flying into the stands, and they do this scene where like people are catching it like it's a foul ball at a baseball game.
Right.
Which I thought, like, all those little touches bring it sort of into the modern day in a really cool way.
Right on.
But yeah, I like this movie. I like this movie a lot.
You know, this movie got some awards. MTV Music Awards cleaned up. Nominations for Best Kiss, Best Musical Sequence, Breakthrough Female Performance.
It lost all those, but
lost all
nominated,
them to American Pie.
That was right. To Moulin American Rouge. Pie 2.
And American Pie 2 and Mandy Moore and A Walk to Remember.
Wow. You think she would have been bigger if she won that?
This is a scandal of the MTV films. Like, this is the Oscar. This is Forrest Gump winning over Pulp Fiction.
Right.
This is, you know, that kind of, it's in retrospect seen as a travesty. But what were you about to say?
Do you think she would have been bigger, the lead woman in this, if she had won the MTV award instead of Mandy Moore?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Think she would have had that breakout?
Oh, she would have had Mandy Moore's career.
I'd say
I don't know. Mandy Moore, like, I'm actually talking shit about Mandy Moore. I don't know. Hell, she could be, you know, she could
win
Mandy
an Oscar.
I think
Mandy Moore's career was A Walk to Remember.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Like, I think she had a music, but she's like one of those, like, where, like, you had Britney, and then you had Christina Aguilera, and then there was, like, Pink. That's like the Arnold, Sly Stallone, JCVD, and then, like,
and then you had Vitamin C, and then you had Mandy Moore.
Mandy Moore was in there doing stuff. There was a lot of, like, blondes making music, it turns out, back then. So, like, I don't know. Maybe she is some fucking absolutely amazing success in Lifetime movies or something. I don't know. That could be.
Maybe.
I bet she's in a lot of Christmas movies.
I was going to say, give her Hallmark Lacey Channel. Chabert's career.
I bet she spent some time in Canada between August and October, shooting a blistering 2 week shooting schedule.
Right. Shoot four Christmas movies over the course of 2 months.
Yeah. At that one gazebo and that one in that one Vancouver town. But I don't know. That's A Knight's Tale. It's 20 years old. Congratulations to making it two decades. Still people fondly. And I know I've talked some shit about the film, but honestly, a big smile on my face throughout the whole time. It's a good time at the movies. Again, is this a prestige film? I don't know. But it's
hard to call this pulp, though, right? Like, it's a romantic comedy, and it's anachronistic history, but it's not like laser guns
It's almost like we created a category that's defined by not being cape shit robots.
Yes.
And spaceships.
It's other. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, the other stuff you like that you didn't, there's no, none of the, you know, it's like, we even put Fast and Furious into the pulp category because, you know, just who needs, it's pretty pulpy, but of course Pulp Fiction would be in prestige.
I'll admit this is borderline. I don't know that I can reasonably call it prestige, but I also wouldn't call it pulp.
Yeah, real talk, we didn't put this in prestige and we'd have to do another fucking movie podcast this week. Yeah. And we already had a cook, and that just wasn't going to happen. So we got the breastplate stretcher and we just poured this into the prestige feed, and it fit. It checked out. That's it for A Knight's Tale. Happy 20th anniversary to everyone involved. We'll be back next week with another prestige film. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See ya.